We are multifaceted people with multifaceted talents. And if there's something that's pulling you, just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to follow it.
Welcome to Midlife, Living in Full Expression. And I'm Julia von Winterfeld. Midlife is not a crisis. It's not a standstill. It's not a burnout. It's an invitation to pause. To shed old roles and to ask, perhaps for the very first time, who do I truly want to become in the second half of my life? So let's dive in, and I'm just simply glad you're here. Welcome, welcome to a new episode of Midlife, Living in Full Expression. And today I have the immense honor of speaking with someone who has shaped the creative industry for over three decades, Rosie Arnold. And amongst other employees, the one that stands out most is her 32-year stint at BBH, so Bartle Bogle Hegarty, where she was the deputy executive creative director, at least that's what it says on LinkedIn. But she is really a creative powerhouse behind iconic campaigns. And I think we can very well say that Rosie redefined what it means to lead with imagination, excellence, and integrity. But today, we'll explore something deeper, what happens when a woman at the top of her game chooses to step off the ladder, what lies beyond the mask of performance, the titles, and maybe even the awards. And today, she describes herself, which I love, as not the consultant piece, but in apt consultants in advertising, leadership, and life. And the best bit about your, I mean, not that I just read your LinkedIn profile, but what I loved about the LinkedIn profile was this humbleness where you then write, "Whoops, I didn't realize I hadn't updated my departure from AMV 3 years ago. Lovely as it was, I became a consultant in 2019. I mean, how honest is that, please? You know, it's not about this is who I am and I'm so grand. It really is true. Just truth in a way. At least that's how I'm reading it. So Rosie, I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad we're going to have this real and rich, no doubt, conversation. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. And yes, it's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
The nice thing is that we've kind of gotten through the technicalities of making this work. So we have gotten to know each other in that sense, but we don't really know each other. I have the pleasure of knowing you a little bit better because of, for our listeners, in most cases, I actually do know the guest quite well. But in this case, I only had the pleasure of hearing you at the ADC Ageism workshop we had here in Hamburg. And I have to really give thanks to Dörte Spengler-Ahrens, who introduced us in a way, or I got to meet you in that sense. So, all the more it's exciting when I don't really know the other side, and we'll see what we can explore. So I think the first question I would have for you is, if you sort of set all the accolades, the titles, and the decades in advertising that you have gone through, who are you today without that spotlight?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question because I think we evolved the whole time, and it was a big decision to leave, but one I felt really ready for, and I am now exploring painting. So there was a sort of point in my life, and I know we're going to get onto that later, where I thought, right, time to go, life is changing, I'm changing. And at first, even though I sort of had the compulsion to go, but I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, although I must confess, I signed up to do a sculpture course, which was like the most expensive thing I'd ever done. And I'd constantly throughout my career had to cancel holidays and things that I really wanted to do because there was always a pitch or an important meeting. Mm-hmm. I lost count of how many times. And I'd signed up for a sculpture course, which again, I had to cancel because there was a pitch. And I thought, right, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to sign up for this. It was a sculpture safari. And I'm going to sign up that. And I'm now going to make sure that I absolutely resign because I can't lose the deposit. So the first thing I did was went on this incredible holiday sculpture thing. And that was just really wonderful thing to do.
Where was it? Just sort of quick.
It was in Zambia.
Oh, wow.
And it was a bit like going on a shoot, actually, because they got us up every morning at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you'd be on this game drive, and then we'd get back to the lodge and sculpt like mad with local clay, and then go back on the evening. It was wonderful, but long hours, but I loved it. But I realized that sculpture was a very difficult thing to do, you know, off your own bat. You need so many tools and expertise, and you know, love it as I do. That was going to be a difficult creative outlet for me. Years ago, I did a sabbatical at the Royal College of Art, and again, I did sort of a three-dimensional project that was dear to me. So I kind of, you know, like I think a lot of creatives, I started out at art school, and the very beginning, I thought I was going to be the next Picasso, and then quickly realised I wasn't. not even that I wasn't. Who knows? I might have been. But that I wasn't going to make a living doing that. It's very hard to, you know, make enough money to support yourself. And that's how I got into advertising. But I went back to painting, and I'm loving it. And I find it quite hard. It sounds quite pretentious to say that you're a painter, because I think the world and his wife always say that. And a lot of people say, oh, I've retired and I'm painting now. And it just sort of grates on me a little bit. And my husband was an artist. My son is an artist. Mm. Lots of my friends are artists and have been all their life and are fabulous. So I feel a little bit like a charlatan saying I'm a painter, but I'm enjoying the process. I'm enjoying learning new skills. And yeah, I'm just going to have a show in September, which is terrifying me because I don't have painting that I like enough. So, but it's great because once a creative, always a creative. It's very good to have a deadline.
Yeah.
So it's definitely energized me. Mm. So that's a very long, rambling answer.
No. I mean, I'm curious because I'm wondering, like, what does actually painting do for you? Because there's, as you said, it's a process. It's then going into it, I'm sure there's also some inner, like, questions, or maybe even like, ugh, you know, can I break through that? But what does it actually do with you?
So I think there's so many things that it gives me, including frustration with my own, you know, ability. But that's a learning curve. And, you know, and I'm very much teaching myself, which, and I think one of the things about being creative, we're so honoured that you have an idea and then you get the world's best technicians to help you bring it to life, which is such a privilege and a joy. But increasingly, I was finding that everybody had an opinion about the idea and, you know, what you should do with it, and don't put that there and put this here, and can we have that larger? And so it's lovely to have a process where I'm the one making every single decision, every mark on the canvas I am making. And if I get it wrong, it's entirely my fault. But it's also the ability, I love oil paint because you can change it and you can scrape it off and you can start again, and you learn the whole time. And I get quite absorbed within that process and the accidents that happen, which actually make it better. And I think that's true of our creative work. You know, I worry that people aren't going on shoots as much and that we're having to generate everything AI, because that takes out the accidents. And I think quite often some of the true genius strokes are the accidents. So, you know, you've gone on location and this hasn't turned up, or the weather's not good, or, you know, it's impossible to shoot it this way, and you have to think round it. And I think painting is that process too. You know, you're doing something hasn't turned out right. You thought it was going to be X, you turn it into Y, and it's better than your original idea. And so I think that I find very fulfilling, and I think it's something I always enjoyed while I was working. So, you know, dealing with happy accidents or unhappy accidents, but just dealing with them, and then you have the power to change them. And it's quite contemplative, I think, as well. You know, you're in a studio on your own rather than with a group of people. I miss the camaraderie of a group of people, but I always liked thinking of ideas, you know, sort of a little bit independently. And I think I like, you know, working. I'm one of those sort of painters or things like when you were a kid and you were doing a drawing and you'd hold your arm over the drawing so people couldn't see what you were working on until you were ready. I'm very like that. You know, I don't like showing people half finished things or, you know, so, but the process is, I find, very therapeutic. And I think it's, you know, popular word, but it's very mindful because, you know, I think we're just doing that, really.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Coming back to, we'll go straight into it, like the AI piece, and it sort of sounded like, yeah, there's some questions at least, like where is creativity going these days? And I'm like curious, what is it that is, in a way, moving you in regards to the context that you've always been in? Is there anything that you're seeing that you're like, wow, that wasn't for us, you know, when I was in the creative world in an employed state?
So there's a massive debate about that at the moment. And it's interesting because the photographer Rankin, who I like him very much, and he's just doing a huge show in London, and he's got ChatGPT to write a letter to the king, you know, and prime minister, and talk about the effect of AI on the creative industry. And it's, you know, it's a hot potato, particularly I think in the UK, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, how important it is to develop it. And without us really knowing the impact it's going to have, it's difficult. We're in a very changing, shifting world. And with all things, there are some fantastic things that AI can do. I'm hoping it's going to cure lots of horrible diseases and things. And, you know, you and I just now trying to work out how how to get the technology working. You know, now I go to chat, you know, GPT or whatever it's called, to help me. And it just gives you solutions, which it's outsourced from billions of different places, and it works. So technologically speaking, it's fantastic. Creatively, I'm sure it's fantastic. You know, this I can have a duck flying backwards singing the national anthem without, you know, a second thought. But the issue I was alluding to before was the problem with that is, if I can have exactly what I want, where are the happy accidents? You know, DNA wouldn't have been discovered the model hadn't fallen in on itself. So are we going to end up just regurgitating past creative discoveries rather than finding our own? So on one level, I don't know. Who knows? And it might be that you go, well, I'm going to use ChatGPT or AI to do all the boring jobs. But then you put a lot of people out of work. So it's very difficult. It's a you know, so it can be a force for good, it can be a force for bad. Since I've sort of stopped working, I'm really pulling away from a lot of technology. It might be that, you know, painting the process is so human, and I think and the problems are so real and in front of you. You know, that bit of paint's gone in the wrong place, I'm going to scrape it off. You know, I don't have to then delve into this box of tricks that I don't really know what I'm doing, and I've got to try 25 things before I get it to work, and I'm not entirely sure why it's now working when it wasn't before. So, you know, that I spend so much of my life doing that. So I think, you know, it feels like a very honest, real thing to do, and it feels human. And I enjoy that. I mean, I'm a generation, I didn't even have a calculator when I was at school. So the shift with technology is enormous. So
crazy. Yeah, things we can't even believe anymore that it was still possible to think and do without technology. But yeah, as I promised sort of at the beginning, it's, we could probably go on, and maybe we'll circle back at the end to where things are going. But as promised, love to sort of dive a little bit deeper into your life and understand, because how I received you, I just felt like there's so much wisdom and of course experience, but there's also this energy that's continuing. And you just spoke, you're not in work anymore, not in the traditional sense of some employer, and but you're, you know, you've, to me at least, you feel very young at heart, and still, even with your painting, discovering and exploring. So maybe first of all, the question also for the listeners, when did you realize it was now time to leave, to, you know, to take yourself out of this world?
Well, it's kind of quite a long process, I think, actually. So I think in 2011, I'd started to sort of kick my heels a bit. By the way, it's interesting you mentioned deputy rather than ECD. I think I enjoyed that role more because it took me, being an ECD would have taken me to sort of manage the department more. And what I liked about being deputy was I had much softer management role. So I could be much more about the welfare of the creative department, inspiring the creative department. And I enjoyed that role enormously. I didn't really want to get into the hiring, firing, you know, numbers and crunchy things like that. So that was a kind of a bit of a conscious decision, really. Which might interest your listeners, really. But I think I was getting to the point where I found the more senior you were, the further away you were from creating ideas, and that was my, you know, my drug, the come up with the idea and then make it happen. And I think I was kicking my heels a little bit about, oh, you know, do I need to demote myself or what do I need to do? And actually at that point, I then became president of DNAD in its 50th year. So that was in 2012, that was. And that was the most astonishing year. I mean, it was proper hard work, two big jobs. I loved it and really tried to put a lot of creative energy into, you know, moving DNAD forward, making it more international, making it more, you know, female, just changing a lot of things. You know, we introduced the first award for work that did good in the world. And, you know, so I think I felt that was an incredibly valuable year and really stretched me. I hated making speeches, but by the end, I had got used to making speeches around the world. So, you know, big personal development learning curve. Sadly for me, at the end of that year, going into 2013, my husband became very ill, and I had stopped work and cared for him. And it was a very awful 2 years. So he had acute myeloid leukemia, which is really a terrible illness. And he was blinded and paralyzed and went through chemo and radiotherapy and had a bone marrow transplant, but very sadly he didn't make it. So I think those 2 years, I mean, I managed to go back to work a bit and make a couple of commercials when we thought things were getting a bit better, but it was a very tricky time, and I slept every night in the hospital next to him. So, you know, life lessons, and I went back to work very quickly, I think partly because I wanted my children to feel that life was moving forward, because we'd all looked after him. So I went back, and BBH were fantastic. They were really supportive, and I went back and worked for a year. But honestly, the reason I left BBH was I felt things had changed so much in my life. Going back to the same office, it just felt like I was in denial and that I needed a big shift. And but again, you know, I went as creative partner, head of art to AMV, because I didn't want the executive role. I wanted to stay close to creativity. You can imagine I was offered quite a few positions, being like terrifying, I have to say. Some of the jobs are so terrifying. I thought, I don't want to do that. That's far too grown up. So I had a lovely time at AMV, but I just got to the point where I was like, I think my particular journey had been, I just need to do something for me now. And honestly, I think I got a little bit impatient with the industry, with the amount of changes. And, you know, I think there's a thing when you're older and the junior marketing director tells you that they don't like your idea or they want you to change it, you kind of go, really? Like, what? Or we don't like this typeface. And I just found myself being a little bit intolerant about that, to be perfectly honest. So, you know, I think the industry is shifting a lot. And I was very fortunate to be at a time when we had long time lengths, and I was a bit spoiled, really. I think, you know, poster campaigns, fabulous. And I love, you know, having an idea that goes through all media, but I just think quite often the budgets aren't there to bring them to life in a way that it really excited me. And that's, you know, I still see work that I just go, God, that's astonishing. And isn't it wonderful? And, you know, it's still possible. But I think you know, for all those reasons, I just was at the point where I thought, right, now's my time to sort of move on and do something for me.
So. Totally understandable. And you know what sort of, for me at least, comes through is you constantly are talking about the idea. It doesn't feel as though, it was about, I'm now, you spoke about deputy and then ECD role, but it doesn't seem to me as though it was about the titles. You really were always about the idea. And then with that moment in your life where things shifted, it's like, okay, no, this isn't for me, but maybe I can create in a different way, in a different place, but not in that environment where I go back to something. At least that's how it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of ironic because I think I've got the kind of, the roles I enjoyed was I did enjoy nurturing talent. Mm. So probably what used to be perceived as feminine roles, whether they are or not, I don't know. But I'd much prefer, bringing people on and helping them come up with ideas. And, I enjoyed that part of it, but I wouldn't have liked to fire people. I'm sure nobody likes firing people, but I think that some people like to create a structure and that wasn't my motivation. Mm. So definitely for me, it's always been about the ideas, and the titles aren't that important.
Mm. And how was it for you? I mean, you being accomplished in your craft, and obviously in how you then delivered your craft. How was it? Was there a lot of power play? How was it at the time being a woman in that environment? Is there anything you can share there?
It was a very male environment that I was working in. I always tried to shift things through enthusiasm. I felt enthusiasm was the most important tool in my box, and positivity. And I would sometimes purposefully misunderstand sexist remarks or whatever it was. I would just literally play dumb on it, and which I think kind of helped. I also had games that I played, which still make me laugh to this day, because we'd have a Monday morning creative directors meeting at BBH when there was, quite a lot of us in the room, all men. It was 8 o'clock Monday morning. Drove me nuts because I had kids and school and all that sort of stuff, but I'd get in purposely at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, and they'd all talk about the blooming football, the results from the weekend, and I would just get, I'll come in half an hour later if you guys are going to spend the first half an hour talking about football. But then all the analogies would be very male sporting analogy, let's get the ball over the net, so I would then introduce female supposedly things. So have we got enough cloth to cut this?
Yeah, brilliant.
They didn't know what I was doing, but I would just have a little secret giggle to myself that I was just changing the analogies. But I think I was lucky. BBH was, even though it's a sexist world, BBH was pretty good about having a lot of women, and leading from the top. John Hickety's not sexist in any way, so I think that definitely filtered through. And one of the most fantastic things about being a creative is it is a meritocracy. Mm. So you are judged by the quality of your ideas, and people can see what they are rather than it being something more nebulous. So I think that's a real advantage to being a woman as a creative.
Mm. Sometimes, I don't know if it's the same for you, but sometimes I'm looking at, younger women and just like in awe as to how they are, far more conscious. I can remember in my own agency times as well, where I would either also laugh it off or actually not really get it that it was in any way sexist. And it's like, okay, that's just how it is. How I in moments took it. And I'm just sometimes in awe how, women are standing up for oneself so much better today.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Mm. And I like calling things out. To me, I just go, I absolutely know. I can almost give you the exact date that the world shifted. Mm. I would go 15th of October, 2015, Me Too. So everyone would be paying lip service to equal pay. Nobody was doing it because they weren't accountable. Mm. And the minute men started to get frightened about being called out, that's when the world changed.
Mm.
And I think that's when it gave girls power, because people felt, actually, this is a really powerful tool. And now guys are frightened that they're going to be found out or called out. And I think that's when things shifted, which has been amazing.
Absolutely.
It's really good to see, you know. So,
yeah.
I'm like you, in awe of the girls. I think they're doing brilliantly.
Yeah.
Women.
Absolutely. Absolutely, women. And I mean, coming back to this moment of shifting yourself into a different environment, is there anything, if you look back today, is there anything, and maybe this is more than to the listeners, that you would suggest or simply tell either your younger self or these listeners, you know, if they are in that moment of, okay, maybe not through the same context, but certainly wishing to move into something else. What is it that allows, or what would you tell them so that they actually move and do something?
I think we're all a little bit fearful, particularly when you're a later stage in your life, because you're quite settled. You might have a family, you have a flat, or you have, you know, financial responsibilities, which make it much scarier to move on. Mm. And I think they can be trapping. Mm. And I would go, have confidence. You've achieved something, you've been successful. That doesn't mean that's the only thing you're going to be successful in. Mm-hmm. So actually take strength from the fact that, you know, when you went into whatever it is you're doing and you've achieved some recognition, some success, some freedom, you know, or joy from it, that's not the only thing. We are multifaceted people with multifaceted talents. And if there's something that's pulling you, just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to follow it. And I think the other thing I'd say is, quite often, if you'd asked me when I was leaving whether I was going to paint, I'd have gone, don't be ridiculous. I'm no good at painting. You know, it wasn't necessarily the thing that drew me. It was just a desire to own my own time a little bit more and do things for me and have a bit more blue sky. And what helped me was to go back to who I'd been in my teens, about what were the things I really loved, what did I enjoy, what were my dreams and my passions then, you know. It wasn't to go into advertising. Luckily, I found a job I love. But what was it? What was it inspired me? And I think it's quite helpful to have that little sort of exercise, or say, what's my perfect day and how do I work towards having more perfect days? So, you know, whether that's, I don't know, a walk on the beach or a dancing in a nightclub, whatever it is, what can I do to make my life more fulfilled and do the things that I really love doing rather than the things I feel I have to?
Mm. And do you think that life, I mean, takes us on a path that where we then, you know, either go into agency world or do whatever we're meant to do career-wise, and when society says this is what you should be doing, therefore you move into it, and then life is actually all about finding out what did you love when you were young, and is there something, you know, that you can reflect back on and bring it to life in later years?
I think that's exactly what I'm saying, which is, you know, everyone goes, no one wants to spend more time in the office when you're in bed, do they? You know, so you want to go, what can I do that will power me forward? And the thing I think is quite interesting is, it was a game I played with all my son's friends, and I'd say, you know, what's your perfect day? And they'd write, you know, we'd talk about the perfect day, and then you go, right now, what jobs will allow me to have my perfect day every day? And so many people get caught up with, oh, well, I can't do that, I need to earn a lot of money to do what my perfect day is. So for instance, one of my sons, he came from a really, background that they were all in the city and they made a lot of money. But what he really loved doing, which was a very weird thing for a young man to like doing, he liked going to Scotland and deer stalking. I don't think they shot the deer or anything, but, you know, just doing this outdoorsy Scottish. And I was like, well, why don't you go and do estate management? Because then every day you would be, you know, waking up in Scotland and you would be looking after the deer and you'd be, you know, your dream day would be every day. And he went, no, I'm going to go make a lot of money in the city. And then that means, you know, for 2 weeks every year, he can do the Scottish thing. And I was thinking, well, might have been nicer for you. So he's somebody I might talk to a little bit later and go, well, maybe now's the time you should do your estate management and, you know, do that every day. So if that helps anyone, just think, what would I like to do?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant question. Really brilliant. Maybe you should just, you know, put these things on your refrigerator and remind yourself every day. And then maybe one day you do make that shift, but it's more conscious you're not pulled in or sucked into the world that maybe you didn't ever want to enter into.
And you know, I think these days, going sort of circling back a little bit to AI, and without being too depressing about it, but just, you know, I think the job market is quite difficult. So finding something within a passion, there seems to be a lot of room for that. So in lockdown, a few of my friends down in Cornwall have found real success out of something that you think was a very difficult situation. So for example, there's a lady down here, a woman down here, who knits funny little creatures and posts them. It's a thing that she loves doing, and they're brilliant and they're quite quirky. Yeah. Somebody in Japan picked up and made a little animated film with some of them. And this person in Japan had a lot of followers. And Claire suddenly found that she'd got a million followers and was like, well, how do I monetize this? Because I can't sell enough of these little, I can't make them quick enough. So she had this idea about just designing the patterns for them. So now she just, and the patterns you can sell for whatever it is, not, you know, let's say $1.99 or $2, I don't know. But you're not actually creating the creatures. You're just creating a pattern that you can just send to people. So it's an absolutely brilliant idea. And she's loving it. She's, you know, creating all these lovely, weird, quirky things with lights in them and mobiles and goodness knows what, with this enormous audience, and doing what she loves and being very well remunerated for it. So I think that's one of the great things about today, that we live in a world where people enjoy our eccentricities and our passions, whatever they be. So,
And most probably, at least that's a belief of mine, you know, the more that we get into that kind of what I just enjoy doing, I think we would potentially, I mean, it's wishful thinking, but live in a far more peaceful, let's say, world than what we're experiencing at the moment. But I, there's also another curiosity in me, and that is, I mean, technically you're retired, right?
Yes.
I hate that word, retired. It really feels like you're tired now. You're like, okay, off you go. But how does that land with you? I mean, what did it feel like? What was it like? Do you ever think about retirement?
No, I don't. Well, I know so many people have a very difficult relationship with that word. I've always been quite contrary about words that people find difficult. So, you know, for instance, when I was going through the menopause, it was like a swear word. Mm. And people looked at some menopausal woman as an insult. And I then took it upon myself to use the word as many times as I could every day. And I think, you know, this retired is a little bit like that. Sorry about my phone. Mm. But I think the trouble is you don't want to be seen as old and irrelevant. And, you know, and I think that's the issue, because, you know, when you think of a retired person, you see them, you know, playing golf or doing whatever their hobby is, but it just feels like they're just, you know, shuffling off this mortal coil. And I don't feel like that at all. I feel I've got lots of new challenges, and I think it's staying curious about stuff, whatever, even if that is playing golf, but just staying curious. And, you know, I've got lots of friends now who are, you know, embarking in other careers or trying different things. And, you know, I did mention I'm sort of part of a network of creatives, retired creatives, never retired, who sort of got a band together going, well, we know we're a collective that if clients want to crack a brief really quickly, they can sort of look and see who's on the list of these, you know, it's called Super Talent, but who's on the list. And, oh, well, we'd love to work with Graham Fink because he's amazing. And, you know, if Graham's interested in it, he might do the project. Or if Martin Galton's interested, he might do it. Or I am. But the lovely thing is it's in our remit. So we might go, actually, I don't really want to work on whiskey or whatever it is. But, you know, if the client's for it. So that's a new sort of I haven't worked on any projects yet. But if something interesting comes along, I definitely would. So there's that. And I think everyone I know who's sort of my age and stage and past advertisers seem to be doing so much, you know, maybe that's just the way our brains are wired. Or the fact that there was a really funny thing doing the rounds, which was a picture of an old TV show called Golden Girls, and with the ages of the actresses. And then beneath it was, you know, Sex and the City and the act of the actresses' ages. And it just shows you that we have a completely different mindset about aging now. You know, and if I look at my parents' generation and what they were when they were in their 60s, we're totally different.
Mm-hmm. And would you...
Sorry,
go ahead. No, you
go. I remember I was very scared about being 50 because I was like one of the oldest people at the, you know, at BBH. And I was kind of worried about whether I should try and keep it secret. And then in the end, I remember I was speaking to my brother and said, well, I don't know if I should have a party. And he went, put it this way, you're going to enjoy a 50th more than you are a 60th. Not true, I enjoyed them both. But so now I've got no problem with people knowing my age. And I just feel like, you know, every age has something to offer. Yeah.
And would you, I mean, if we, I'm in my 50s, others obviously who are listening are probably in their 50s as well. What would you say to them now if they feel like they're fading into the background? What is it that they can do to bring themselves back into?
In terms of fading into the background, work-wise or life-wise?
I think actually both. The conversations that I'm having, there's a little bit of, so on the life side, it's more about, okay, now I have to take care of my parents. You know, the children have just left the house. So now I thought I would now have a chance, but no, I'm off to my parents and supporting them. But also, some also not even knowing how their relationships are going to continue.
It's not what people tell you, is it? You know,
no.
You just think, oh, and they live happily ever after, and
exactly.
They've kind of crossed over. I think it is a very challenging time for women because your body is changing. I think society still likes young women, so you know, you go to the bar and everybody ignores you when you're trying to order drinks. Sort of, you know. So I think there is a feeling that you are becoming irrelevant and invisible, and that's tough, particularly if you've been dynamic and forceful in your job, and you know. Probably if you've been attractive and, you know, so I think all of that is a lot to come to terms with. And I think generally the looking after the parents role tends to fall to the women. I think the caring role, you know, in every aspect falls to women. And then you get lost because one, no one's noticing you. Yeah. And two, you're subsumed with caring. And it's, you know, it is difficult. And I think I would say, you know, I've had that stage. Sadly, my mum died after my husband. But, you know, I've done that and it is very tough. And I think you just need to make sure that you hang on to doing a few things for yourself and making that really important that you just go, well, what is for me? Whatever that might be. And I think men are very good at making their hobbies important. So that's the thing I noticed with my friends. It seems like every husband takes up cycling. And then it's very important that they go on whatever cycle ride it is at the weekend. And off they go with all their friends, leaving the wife to do the cleaning, the housework, the looking after the parents, the, you know, looking after the children if they're still at home. Mm. And then they both go back to work for the weekend. And I think women have not made their own needs important, you know. And I'm still at this point going, well, why is it more important that he goes for a cycle ride, that you don't go to do whatever it is you want? And I think we just have to be a bit assertive about, actually, this weekend, I am going to go to do this. Or it, even if it is like, well, you do your cycle ride on Saturday, and then on Sunday, I want to do this. But I think we need to be more assertive about our needs and a little bit more selfish. Of course, you need to look after your parents. That's just it, but you need to reward yourself. And I keep thinking the best advice I can give to people is, what advice would you give to your best friend? And then you do it to you. So if your best friend is run ragged and in a difficult relationship, what would you say to them? And then try and apply that to yourself. It's hard to do, but I think it makes you kinder to yourself. I think we're tough on ourselves, and I think you're kinder to your friends. So be kind to yourself. That's what beautiful. I would say.
Yeah, and really, really, as you said, it's a difficult question, but as in really to answer it honestly, then to apply to your own self. But that's where maybe the magic and the truth actually lies, when you open yourself to that answer. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sort of now with my mind going into the future and wondering where is your journey continuing? You've mastered what I call midlife, and with all the ups and downs, but you've gone through this. It seems with not only your painting but also with the super talents that your collective, let's say, has brought together. Yeah. Where would you want to still, if at all, have impact? What is it for you?
I had a girl, young creative, come live with me for a long time, and I'm enjoying, and I still do a bit of teaching. So I love things like this as well, nurturing people. I love trying to help people. I think it's so rewarding. Giving is just lovely. So passing on any wisdom is a total joy to me. If you can help one person in any way, that is just fabulous, even if you don't know about it. I think that I really love that. And I think my 60s, you're sort of easier in a way, because I think you found out who you are. You've got a bit more selfish about what you want to do, and you have a bit more time. I think I've noticed that I've learned to say no more often, because I'm a very people pleaser. I say yes all the time, but actually being able to say no and strip things away is very empowering. And I'm very aware that this decade is probably one of the most important decades in terms of being fit enough, hopefully, thank God, touch wood, to be able to do things, solvent enough, and bold enough, because I've observed that when people sort of start getting into their 70s, things just become a little bit more irksome. Travel becomes more irksome. I don't want that to happen to me, so I'm still making sure I travel and I do things, but I don't know what's going to happen. So I feel, okay, here I am in my 60s, do the things that I love, say no to the things I don't love, help as many people as I can, be generous with my time, and be kind to myself. So yeah, I'll try to.
There's a study I would have to find, and then I can also put it into the show notes. But to that point, being not only kind, but this giving aspect that you spoke about, because there's so much, I don't know how you've been following this, but this whole loneliness epidemic, let's say, and we're all becoming lonelier for many reasons, but particularly also because of technology, that there is this sort of, how do we create a sense of belonging in organizations, in groups of society?
Yeah, so important.
So important.
You know, I did something which it started partly selfishly. So when Pete died, I had a dog and my husband was at home painting. And I thought, oh, I'm going back to, what am I going to do about the dog? Because I work long hours. So I thought, I know, I'll get a student to live with me, and they don't have to pay any rent at all, zero. But the deal is they have to look after the dog, bearing in mind that I will have a dog walk occasionally, whatever. And I thought, all right, get on with artists. I can't have an artist because they'll need to be at the studio. So I'll find somebody who's doing theoretical art. This is a very logical process. So I went to all the art schools that do theoretical art and went, free accommodation for a student who deserves it most. So I've ended up going the courthold where they went, right, yep, with the student union. And I said, I'm not going to vet them. I just want the person you think deserves free accommodation the most. So I ended up with a boy, and I thought a girl might be better, but I ended up with a boy from Bhutan called Karma, which is hilarious. So anyway, he came to live with me. I had no idea about Bhutan. He was really lovely. Got a bit much towards the end because he kept having his friends come and stay with me from Bhutan for months on end. That got a bit much. and then I was part of this thing called Creative Equals, which is a charity. And they said, can you help any of the young students? I went, I've got another spare room. I'll get somebody else in that spare room. So in came Meg, who was doing an advertising course. So there was the three of us. And then Karma moved on and I got a girl from Ukraine to live with us. So I've always got this, and I've got another girl living with me at the moment. And I do it so now I have to charge them a little bit of rent, but for London it is peanuts. Mm-hmm. And the deal is that they do a bit of dog care when they go on holiday or whatever. And then that's it, really. And it's, I just want everyone to do it because it solves loneliness. It solves, poor people trying to find somewhere. Not that, I mean, unfortunate people. I don't mean that. I'm trying to find the right adjective. I mean, I've always struggled with the idea that students find it so difficult to live in cities. Mm-hmm. I tried to get John Hegarty to buy a house so that we could get young creatives to come from outside London. Because if you're not from London, it's almost impossible because you earn no money. Rent is so expensive. So it's a wonderful way of giving a young person an opportunity. Mm. So many of my friends are like, are you mad? You're living with this person. What are they dirty? What do they steal from you? And I've just gone, well, that would be very sad. And they would be ruining a life opportunity. But so far, I have had the most lovely people with wonderful experiences. And, you know, I'm planning to go to Bhutan at some point. My Ksenia from Ukraine has married and moved to Crete, and I'm going to go and see her. And Meg is now in Australia, and I talk to her all the time. And I've got a new girl, Charlie, living with me. And I help them. You know, I've just given them any wisdom I can, and they've got a nice house to stay in. And I thoroughly recommend it. It's lovely.
Yeah, you're proving the point that at least the study was making, is that in giving and in being so generous, that's how you create connection. That's the only way that we can create connection. I mean, anything that is like in a methodology packed into, you know, now we have to talk to one another, it's actually just really giving, which I find so true. And yet we don't naturally do this anymore.
I feel I'm in a privileged position that I have a spare room. And yeah, it's just been lovely to put my key in the door and know someone's there. And we have lots of silly nights watching things. And it's wonderful to have a resident technical expert in the house. But these are all sort of hidden things that I hadn't thought about at all. Mm-hmm. It literally came from, I need someone to look after the dog, I'll do something nice. And then, you know, just moved on from there.
Yeah.
I was trying to sort of see if I could set up a website or do something which would connect people, but it's quite a hard thing to do. And so many people are cynical about it. Mm. But I would just encourage, you know, I don't know what life stage, you know, you could start doing it and how people feel. But also, you know, if you've split up and you're on your own and you're rattling around a house or, you know, and you might need a little bit of income, you don't have to do it for free. I mean, I'm not doing it for free anymore. But, you know, it's just, it's a thing of joy.
Mm, so nice. I would say to wrap this up, and again, still looking into the future, is there a word? I mean, you mentioned curiosity, but is there a word that you want to take into whatever the next chapter, I'm just going to call it, like, what is it that, or maybe it's a sentence that you say, okay, this is what it would be.
I think I'm really concerned about not feeling, how do I say it? I was mad in love with my husband. We were very happy. Mm. That was horrible. But I don't want to be defined by tragedy. Mm. So I feel I'm fighting that, and I'm going, and I look at my life going forward, and I feel what I like to do every day is realize how lucky I am. Mm. And, you know, in the world, we're all so greedy and we want so much, and I've got so much. I've got, you know, children, I've got my health at the moment, I've got the opportunity to paint. So I think going forward, I just feel be kind, be generous, and count your blessings.
Yeah, nice.
That's what I feel.
Mm. It's interesting because on this podcast, we always have a question, which I'm going to ask you as well after this next one. Where I ask the guests to just provide me with a question, you know, all around midlife transitions, what would you want the next guest to answer?
Oh, God.
So I have a question for you from my last guest, which is interesting, and it always feels so fitting. And the question is, I'd have to now look at my notes, how do relationships shift in the second half of life, and what have you noticed? And, of course, relationships in a broader sense. Is anything for you, does anything shift? Because be kind, and you know what you've just said to summarize the next chapter.
I think you learn a lot by the time you hit your 50s. You've learned a lot. So I think what I've noticed is the shift in the desire to help people and pass on that wisdom. And you can't stop them making mistakes, but you can help them through them, or you can help them see them coming or whatever. And I think that's what I notice of myself, that I find I sort of try and have to hold back by not being too telling people how to do things. But I feel it. I feel you can see stuff happening, and I'm constantly trying to find a kind way of helping people and helping impart your experience in a way that's not, oh, well, I know exactly what to do, because you don't know exactly what to do all the time. But what you can do is very gently try and help them find a way through. And I think that's the shift. It's just, it's all about knowledge, actually. It's just, you know, you've seen a lot by the time you hit 60. Mm. And it's how do you impart that in a kind, generous way that doesn't sound like you're lecturing them? You know?
Well, you've certainly proved that here, by the way. I'm going to be listening to it again for sure, because just through some of the questions that you've put into this conversation will certainly trigger in a positive way thought in others, or in, particularly in myself as well. So thank you for that.
I'm trying to think what I would ask the next.
Yeah, exactly. That would be my next question.
Because, you know, you want to sort of say generalizations about, you know, what would you ask your younger self, and all those sort of questions, which I sort of feel somebody will have already asked. So midlife, I think I would say, is there anything that you're itching to do that you've been denying yourself? Mm. And recognize that, and then try and make it happen.
Exactly. And then stick it in the refrigerator and make sure you look at it every day and get there slowly. Yeah, brilliant. No, I will definitely take that question, and thank you. Thank you, really. Yeah. I knew it would be a wonderful conversation. I'm even more happier now knowing that we had the conversation.
You're also kind and generous.
Yeah. No, seriously, I think it's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. And as I say, it's been a real privilege. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of the Midlife Podcast, Living in Full Expression. I hope Rosie's story reminded you, just as it did me, that retirement isn't the end of relevance. It's the beginning of reimagining what fulfillment looks like without titles, roles, or the pressure to perform. So midlife is not a decline, it's a deepening. And as Rosie beautifully showed us, it's never too late to follow your curiosity, to return to forgotten passions, and to live from a place of enoughness. If this conversation touched something in you, if you loved it, or if you liked it, then go ahead, share it. You can rate it, you can like it, you can leave a comment, or even send me a personal email at julia@soulworks.de. I would be happy to hear from you. And if you're ready to explore your own second half of life with more clarity, courage, and connection, come join us in the Unmasking Midlife community. It's where the real conversations continue. So until next time, stay true, stay curious, and above all, stay kind with yourself.